Its motto was to feed the world. We're tracing the history of the seed empire, the herbicide powerhouse Monsanto, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The St. Louis area chemical giant was acquired by Bayer in 2018, but its story, it starts at the turn of the 20th century with this fledgling company trying to stay afloat, making saccharin and caffeine for Coke. So we travel through its history, making chemicals like DDT, like Agent Orange, the weed killer Roundup. Environmental historian Bart Elmore points out that in our Cheerios this morning, there are trace amounts of glyphosate, the chemical that controls broadleaf weeds and grasses used widely in the U.S. What do you wonder about chemical herbicides and their history? What pressures have you faced to use Roundup on your fields? 800-642-1234. Bart Elmore is an associate professor of environmental history at The Ohio State University. His new book is called Seed Money, Monsanto's Past and Our Food Future. Bart, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So there's a little over 14 million acres and change of farmland here in Wisconsin. Give us some scale first, some lay of the land. How much chemical herbicide and how much genetically engineered seeds is going into our croplands in America? And where does Monsanto fit into the scale in this overall picture?
Right. That's a great point. You know, what I say in the book is that whether you're a tofu eating vegan or a, you know, high fructose corn syrup drinking soft drink drinker, you are consuming genetically modified crops in some form or fashion, because in the U.S., you know, roughly 90% of soybeans grown and corn grown in the United States is genetically engineered in ways to tolerate herbicides, to produce pesticides in some ways. So it's just become the norm. And I think what's so interesting as a historian is how relatively new that is. You know, 1996 was the introduction of the first genetically engineered crops in the U.S. For commercial use. And the just rapid adoption of this technology was so striking in the book. So I think we're all connected to it here in the U.S. in some form or fashion. Most of these crops, of course, were originally genetically engineered to be tolerant to Roundup, the herbicide that Monsanto had created back in the 1970s. And so again, there's this kind of connection I think we all have, not only to these crops, but also to the chemicals that come with them. And like I said, whether you're, you know, eating tofu or other things, there's probably some connection to it that you have in your life. So it felt to me like a story that I was interested in, because I eat all these things too, and I wanted to know more about it. So I kind of went back to the beginning of all this to think about, how did we get here? And to your point about Monsanto, how did this company become the largest seed seller in the world? Well, by the end of the 20th century.
It's interesting you say that, because what I keep saying through Seed Money is, who is Monsanto? It's like it keeps morphing into something else from, I would say, innocent caffeine, and then you got DDT and Agent Orange and synthetic fibers and all laundry detergent, and then Roundup, and then suddenly, like whiplash, genetically engineered seed dynasty of the world. And so I keep saying that to myself, who are you, Monsanto? And I'm wondering, can you acquaint us with these different iterations of the company over the generations, and what has caused them to keep changing their focus and their products?
Okay, I love how you lay it out, because I felt the same way, you know. And I should note that it took almost a decade to write this book, and I took a lot of time because I really wanted to get the story right. And like you, you know, I went back and I kept waiting for the story of agricultural chemicals, because it was late. You know, there's this whole prehistory long before Roundup that I thought was really interesting. So, yeah, you know, the story really begins with a kind of scrappy startup. Is the best way to think about Monsanto in 1901. It's a chemical company based in St. Louis that's really trying, in a weird way, to outcompete pesky firms like Bayer, this German chemical company, and overseas that are kind of the giants of the time. And I think one of the great ironies of the book is that, of course, Bayer will gobble up Monsanto at the end of the book.
What comes around goes around.
Right. Well, much to the chagrin of John Queeny, right, who started the company, who wanted to have independence from the Germans. That was kind of the whole vision. And I tried to tell human stories, as you noted at the top of the hour. I wanted to get to know these folks, you know, instead of, I think if we take history as a story of people that are trying to make it in the world and see them in their own time, then we tell better history than just kind of creating stock characters that are villains or otherwise. So yes, I start with John Queeny, and then, you know, he's just trying to survive, and he picks saccharin, this artificial sweetener, as you noted, as his main product to start, because there's this booming soft drink industry, and he thinks that's the best thing he could invest in, is selling saccharin to companies like Coca-Cola. And in fact, if it weren't for Coca-Cola's contract with Monsanto in 1901, the company wouldn't exist. Basically, Coke bought all of their saccharin and sweetened their beverages without telling the public, by the way, that they were sweetening their beverage with an artificial sweetener as early as 1901, because it was cheaper to do so. And then, as you said, there's so many other products that come along the way. Caffeine became a huge product for Monsanto, and actually was the main profit generator for the company. Company selling caffeine to Coke as well. And I'll just say, you know, he named this company after his wife, Monsanto, in part because he was a drug salesman for another company. And he didn't want to have confusion. Is this Queeny Chemical Company? Wait a minute, isn't he working at another drug company? He was moonlighting to get this thing up and running.
And he's like 40-something years old with a lot to lose, I think. I mean, he wasn't young in starting this company.
No, especially at a time where life expectancy was like 47 or 48, I want to say, back in the early 1900s. So, no, he had tried to make it before. And so he's, as I said, somebody just trying to survive. And he has two kids. I really sympathized, you know, like I'm in the same boat. I have two kids back home, and he's just trying to provide for them in so many ways. And he sets off on this journey that ultimately is going to lead to all these stories we'll talk about in the hour. That I don't think he ever envisioned in many ways, you know, starting out in just saccharin and caffeine. So go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm just going to reintroduce you here. Bart Elmore is an environmental historian, author of the book Seed Money. You can join in. What would you like to know about Monsanto? How does Monsanto affect your daily life? Share your experience, 800-642-1234. So how did the Great War, World War I, contribute to Monsanto really getting its toehold, if you will, on U.S. chemicals and really becoming a global player? Because, you know, Europe had all of these chemical giants, and in Germany, and even, you know, Queeny, like, imports a few chemists just to get his business off the ground.
Exactly. And I think, again, it's important to think about that. You know, we're going to end the story with Monsanto being so powerful, but at the beginning, it's just trying to survive. It's importing its chemists from overseas because, I mean, get this, John Queeny, speaking to Congress in the 1920s, the founder of Monsanto, is quizzed on some of the chemicals that he produces. And the senator asks him and says, "Hey, sir, could you tell us a little bit more about this compound?" And John Queeny, and this is a quote, says, "Sir, you're getting into chemistry, on which matter I'm rather weak," you know, and I think that's crazy to think about. All these things that we're going to be connected to, all these petrochemical products that are around us today that affect our lives. The founder of the company really didn't even know what they were about. You know, he didn't have a chemistry background. He didn't even go to high school. And so he's having to import a lot of these folks from overseas. And you're absolutely right. World War I is so key because it cuts off German supplies of chemicals to the U.S. We're at war with Germany. And so that opens up the opportunity for these scrappy companies like Monsanto and other American chemical companies as well. If you think about DuPont and Dow and others, to really get an edge over some of their German competition. And we see this period as a tremendous period of growth for Monsanto because their competition is held at bay.
Author Bart Elmore is detailing the international ecological history of Monsanto. New book, Seed Money, spending nearly a decade with Monsanto. Original documents that are at the heart of this book. Is your farmland dependent on chemicals? What is the role of the EPA and federal regulators to stop the use of harmful chemicals? Are you a farmer who's dealt with pesticide drift on your fields or overspray? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Bart Elmore here on the Ideas Network.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning about the world's most widely used herbicide Roundup and how Monsanto came to have an outsized influence on our food system, becoming the largest seller of seeds in the world. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Environmental historian Bart Elmore explains how Roundup came to be used on more than 90% of all soybeans and corn grown here in the U.S., sprayed over millions of acres of farmland worldwide. What questions do you have about glyphosate, the most widely used chemical in agriculture? Has your farm tried to stay away from such chemicals? What have you done instead? 800-642-1234. Bart Elmore's book is called Seed Money, and he's with us for the hour. Bart, I didn't know Monsanto had this huge role in making Agent Orange for the U.S. military operations in Vietnam, and I assumed it was Dow Chemical. And based on that, I was really taken aback to hear Monsanto courting farmers in Vietnam decades later with their Roundup and really not addressing the human destruction of the chemicals that destroyed people and their environment in Vietnam. Can you take us into that?
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for reading the book closely. It's always so nice to have interviews where you followed along exactly where I was kind of hoping we'd all go. So, you know, I think if the question is, well, wait a minute, they're selling saccharin and caffeine. When did this agricultural chemical business really get off the ground? And you really start seeing this for Monsanto in the 1940s, really after World War II. This becomes a real growth area for the firm. And they recognize that this is a huge market. You've got all these farms and territory to be able to use these chemicals on. Wow, if we can break into these market, this could be amazing. So they really start investing in these herbicides and pesticides in the 40s. And you're right, one of the first chemicals they start pushing and really investing in is a chemical called 2,4-5-T and another chemical called 2,4-D. Both of these compounds are found ultimately in Agent Orange, the herbicide used during the Vietnam War, decades later. And I emphasize that, you know, that Monsanto is working with these compounds for years, long before it's ever used in the Vietnam War, a war I should mention that my father served in overseas. And so I was really interested in that prehistory. So much had been written about Agent Orange and the effect on veterans, and rightly so, and also on Vietnamese citizens overseas. But I thought, well, what happens if we go back to the plant where Monsanto manufactured this material, going back to the 40s when they first started investing in this material? And that was really startling because, to your point, I mean, internally at the plant, and I should mention it's in Nitro, West Virginia, what a name for a town, Nitro, where they were manufacturing this, they were watching their workers really coming down with some really debilitating ailments. Chloracne, for example, you know, pustules like acne on their workers' faces, which was clearly an exposure to some kind of toxic compound coming from the manufacture of 2,4-5-T. One worker, of course, described in the book, it talks about his face being peeled off five times as a result of all this acne that he has on his body. And it just seems so painful to read and to see in the historical record. And again, to think this is 40s, 50s, years before this stuff is going to be sprayed overseas. And I think one of the questions of the book was really to say, you know, where did things go wrong? And how were these signals that were so visible and clear within the industry itself not used to stop this before it be sprayed in Vietnam and used with soldiers overseas? So I thought it was important to tell that story of the workers and to look at that long history, as you noted, of kind of seeing problems early on and yet continuing to produce these products that would have devastating effects down the road.
And you looked at a number of court cases, and hands down, my favorite characters who you introduce us to are these really hell-bent lawyers who spent a large part of their lives, their legal careers, fighting Monsanto. And just the heartbreak of them seeing their clients die from chemical exposure as they, you know, forge on through years of litigation and appeals. And it was truly the most appalling, jaw-dropping thing. This judge approved that Monsanto recoup its court costs, $500,000 reduced to like 300,000, just, you know, drop in the bucket. And they put liens on these plaintiffs' homes to ensure that they would get the money. So these dying plaintiffs now on the hook for all this money that Monsanto wants, that it, you know, I mean, how cruel is that?
Yeah, it was really crazy. You know, as a historian, I feel like it's important to go to the places that you write about. We're up relatively early. It's 8 o'clock, you know, 8:20 where you are. I know farmers might be listening. I spent a lot of time with farmers. You know, I wanted to get to hear their story, the good, the bad. How do they feel about this? And the same thing with the workers. I wanted to go listen to people who were in these places and hear their stories. I think as a writer, that's so important. So I spent time, as you said, with Stuart Caldwell, the attorney who represented these workers in Nitro. So I went down to West Virginia to hear the story. And you're right. I sat in his office. He's been fighting for decades, still fighting against Monsanto for 2,4,5-T. And you're absolutely right. I mean, he tells me the story. These workers in this plant, years later, they file suit against Monsanto. They go to battle for years. It's a long, hard-fought battle. And they lose the case on a technicality, essentially. When they lose, Monsanto, to kind of warn anyone else who wants to follow their path, puts out liens on these workers' homes and says, if you appeal this case, we're going to take your house, essentially. And Stuart Caldwell describes the situation in his law office that day. He said he called the workers in and he said, you know, guys, look, Monsanto is going to come out for your houses if you don't just back down. What do you want me to do? I'm your attorney, you know. And I think it was Ray Bogus who spoke up and said, Caldwell, they can have my house. Mm. You just give me 30 days to get out. And, you know, I think that's the power as a historian when you're reading these stories of these workers who no longer here, by the way. You know, many of these folks would die, some of them of the ailments that they suffered from this exposure. I felt a certain obligation to tell their stories because I think there's loss to history. You know, we talk about, as I said, and rightly so, veterans, Vietnam citizens. But we have to think also about what was going on in these factories. And think about the factory workers who are affected by all this, because I think they tell a story that's really powerful.
Bart Elmore with us, environmental historian, author of Seed Money. You can join in 800-642-1234. Gary is joining us from Boscobel. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been involved for nearly 50 years in trying to purchase and manage and preserve our native bits and pieces of tall grass prairie in the upper Midwest through an organization called the Prairie Enthusiasts. And it's very clear to us that the use of pesticides and insecticides adjacent to many of the sites that we own and manage, which are several dozen, that we have no way of knowing the damage that pesticides through either movement through rainwater washing out of the soils or through drift, the effect that it's having on our sites that are full of endangered and threatened native species, and we don't even have accurate inventories of what's living there, so we have no way of knowing or monitoring what's there and what we're losing to these pesticides that are sprayed generally right up to the fence lines or the borders around our properties that range anywhere from a couple of acres to 150 or 200 acres. So it's extremely alarming to us that try and preserve this biodiversity, native biodiversity, and we know there's impacts of chemicals, but we don't have any way to measure it.
Gary, thank you. Bart, what about this drift?
You know, I think I feel for your caller. I've been, as I said, studying this for a long time. I've been out in the fields and with various folks to kind of look at this story. And I sympathize. I you know, one of the things, there's two things that come to mind. You know, as I mentioned, a lot of these chemicals came out of wartime. You know, the fact that 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D were so popular in the 40s is a product of, you know, the U.S. military thinking about these herbicides as defoliants that could be used during war. Of course, if we fast forward to the Vietnam War, 2,4,5-T, of course, would be used again as a defoliant to try and clear jungles to expose enemy combatants. I think that matters as a historian to point out that there's this kind of connection between a war of war and nature, that there, that mindset, I think, was very much a mindset of the time that, to your caller's point, it is, I think, a little bit dangerous in the sense, not just a little bit, but quite dangerous in the sense that there's a lot of casualties of this war, I think, we've had on weeds and war on pests that go beyond just the targets of those, the initial targets of those weed killers and the pesticides. So I think, in other words, there's a historical philosophy that I think has to be confronted that grew out of a specific time period when these chemicals first emerged that I think really matters. And just to be more specific to the other listeners out there who may not be as close to this as our caller, you know, there's one compound that comes to mind that's particularly problematic, and that's dicamba. That's currently being sprayed a great deal on farms today.
And let's pause there on dicamba. We have a news update here. Author Bart Elmore's latest book traces the roots of Monsanto. And we will pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the history of people who work in crops and the chemicals they depend on from seed giant Monsanto on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Monsanto's Roundup herbicide conquered the market, but weeds still keep popping up. And here's the end of a Roundup ad last year with a woman in a hammock who's relieved of her weed pulling duties. The 30-second spot focuses on the chemical it's promoting for 4 seconds.
Kill weeds to the root with Roundup ready-to-use weed and grass killer with SureShot Wand.
Courtesy of iSpot TV, do you use Roundup on your lawn? Have you ever signed a TUA, a technology use agreement, preventing you from planting saved seeds? Join in, 800-642-1234. Environmental historian Bart Elmore's book is called Seed Money, and he's with us for the hour. We paused there on dicamba, created in the 60s, very volatile drifts, and that really hurts farmers without dicamba-resistant crops. What is the complexity there? Are you there, Bart? Can you hear us?
Yes, yeah, sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
It's interesting to connect the dots, as you say, with dicamba, because if we go back to the story, we left off kind of with Agent Orange. It's all connected, right? Agent Orange is sprayed during the Vietnam War, 2,4-5-T. It's a toxic compound that has this dioxin contaminant in it, is essentially banned. And so Roundup is emerging out of that. Roundup is, you could argue, is the kind of replacement for these more toxic herbicides like 2,4-5-T. And they emerge in the 1970s. Roundup becomes this blockbuster product for Monsanto, and it's especially become significant when they start genetically engineering seeds to tolerate Roundup in the 1990s. At that point, farmers use Roundup in some cases almost exclusively on their farms to deal with their weeds. The problem with that, of course, is that when you spray so much Roundup, you're going to create resistance in weeds. And we start seeing that very clearly by the end of the 90s and early 2000s. Weed scientists here at Ohio State that I interviewed are saying, you know, raising the alarm about this resistance issue. And so there was a problem with these genetically engineered crops. Okay, now we've got this resistance to Roundup developing in weeds. What are we going to do about it? And as you mentioned, dicamba, created in the 1960s, it's an old chemical, comes back in recent times as this chemical that's going to try and kill Roundup resistant weeds. But the problem that we've seen, and this is happening right now in farm country across the country, well, it happened in the growing season, we're now in the winter here, but dicamba is being sprayed on these farms to deal with these Roundup resistant weeds, but it's volatile. When you spray it on a farm, it can jump off target and drift onto adjacent landscapes. And as our caller mentioned, this can include places that aren't just farmland, maybe grassland, and other areas, vineyards, gardens, various places. And what we're seeing over the last 5 to 6 years is this incidence of dicamba drift, with this chemical drifting off target onto farms that have no protection from dicamba. Mm-hmm. And that's the important point. The reason why dicamba is being used in such volume is that Monsanto created a new series of seeds that tolerate both Roundup and dicamba. So you can spray Roundup and dicamba on your crops will survive and it will kill all the weeds. The problem again is that because you're spraying so much dicamba in the hot growing season, it's vaporizing and drifting off target and affecting not just farmers nearby, but hitting sycamore trees, hitting gardens, hitting everything. And today it's a real problem.
And thousands of farmers have told the EPA that it's doing this and it's damaging crops on neighboring lands. How is the EPA responding?
Well, it's interesting. The dicamba-tolerant crops first emerged in 2015 and 2016. And the reports of complaints really started exploding in 2017, 2018, and 2019. The EPA tried to step in and said, okay, we're going to try and restrict, you know, create buffer zones around farms where you cannot spray dicamba to try and prevent this drift. We're going to try and control when you spray it. But none of those measures have ultimately stopped this drift problem. In fact, in December of 2021, and I'm just looking at the EPA site today, it says, these incident reports showed little change in number, severity, or geographic extent, despite these measures to try and control this compound. Hmm. And so there's a real question of what's going to happen in the years to come. Is this chemical dicamba going to be allowed to be used? If so, under what restrictions? But this is a case of a chemical where some farmers, there's no choice. They're getting hit, even though they want to avoid it. And we're talking about organic growers, for example, that don't want anything to do with pesticides, chemical pesticides, being hit by dicamba and affecting their crops. So to me, this is an issue that I think many people who aren't close to farmers may not be hearing about, but it's one that matters because this is where our food comes from. And I think all of us should care a little bit about it and be following it because it's a big story.
Bart Elmore with us, environmental historian, author of Seed Money, Monsanto's Past and Our Food Future. You can join in 800-642-1234. Janine is joining us from Milwaukee and would like to touch on Agent Orange. Janine, go ahead.
Yes, well, first of all, thank you so much for this program and for shining a light on what's happening to farmers locally and around the world as a result of these chemicals. I'm calling with a very personal story. My husband was in Vietnam, and he was exposed to Agent Orange and suffered the consequences of that and spent the rest of his life trying to let people know what happens with Agent Orange and its relatives, its related offshoots, the things that Monsanto has produced ever since. My husband ultimately lost his life to Agent Orange-related leukemia. His story is not unique. It took a long time for the government to acknowledge that his illness was caused by Agent Orange, and we're still using that on our lawns, derivatives of that on our lawns. It's not a happy thought.
Janine, thank you for sharing that personal story. And Janine saying there about Agent Orange and its relatives, which is precisely what you're exploring here.
Yeah, and I feel for the caller, you know. That's an incredible loss, and I'm sorry to hear that. As I said, you know, I have connections to this, too, with family members that serve. And I went back overseas, I should say, to Vietnam to see the sites of Agent Orange cleanup that are ongoing today, because it's not just American soldiers that were affected, of course, Vietnamese citizens overseas. We are now currently, most listeners may not know this, engaging in the first dioxin cleanup campaigns in Vietnam to clean up hotspots where the 2,4-5-T that was used, that had this contaminant dioxin in it, was stored in many of these air bases. We've begun to clean up these sites. U.S. taxpayers are paying for that, with many of you listeners probably not knowing this. Hundreds of millions of dollars being spent, and I think rightly so, to clean this up. One of the questions I have is, what's the obligation of a firm like Bayer or Monsanto that knew about these problems, as I show in the book, going back to the 40s and 50s in their own plant, and sold this dirty product to the U.S. government. What's the obligation of a firm to get involved in those cleanup campaigns? I think it's a real moral question. You mentioned the derivatives. I think it's important to point out that today, what I think the caller is referring to is 2,4-D. As I mentioned, Agent Orange was a mixture of 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D, these two wonky names for chemicals mixed together, 50%, 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D. 2,4-5-T was the problematic part of that Agent Orange. It had dioxin in it, as I said, this contaminant that was the main cause of a lot of these ailments we've been discussing. 2,4-D did not have that dioxin in it, but it is true that 2,4-D is being used on farms today, and it's been used for a very long time, even after the Vietnam War, to kill weeds. And it's becoming even increasingly more important to many farmers, if you spend any time with farmers today, because of Roundup resistant weeds. Farmers are trying to figure out, okay, we've sprayed Roundup, now they're not responding to Roundup because we've used so much of it. They're having to go back to higher quantities of 2,4-D, higher quantities of dicamba. And that's a really old chemistry. You know, it may not have dioxin in it, but a lot of people would say, look, you know, in high concentrations, it's not, this is not necessarily a product that we want to have in large volumes being used on our farms. So that's what I think is important for us to think about, that the future of food right now is looking a lot like our past. We're going back to older and older chemistry to try and sustain our food production. And one has to say, well, what's, you know, is that really the future we want?
I want to look more closely at research and regulation. I'm situated on the campus of a big research university, UW-Madison. Your book made me wonder about funded research and the dollars flowing into the research labs that are trying to figure out whether chemicals that the Monsantos of the world are producing are safe for humans and environmentally safe, ethical. Can you give us more there on whether we're doing enough to separate independent government research from the private funds that keep their labs staffed up and creating value?
It's a great question. And you nailed something that I think is so critical to the book. I think if there's one takeaway from this book, is that we need much firmer firewalls between the corporations that are being regulated in terms of their pesticides being put out and the agencies doing the regulating. You see time and time again, this story, basically the industries that are producing the chemicals, generating some of the studies that are used to justify whether they're safe or not. Mm. And that is a real, real problem. I'll give you two anecdotes there. One is, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with Ohio State University. Let's say it was a risky move.
Your employer.
My employer, to see how much money Monsanto was giving for studies. And it was really startling when I got that funding, you know, that there was, you know, money coming in that was related to the efficacy of various herbicides that the company produced. Mm-hmm. And I know the scientists here are great folks. I really mean that. They have incredible integrity. But yet anyone could say that there's a problem there. That should not be the way that our public universities work. And I think there's a way to change that so that we can have firmer firewalls, as I say, between people that are doing the science and trying to decide whether this stuff is safe and the people that have a vested interest in making it go through. So for me, that's a big deal.
Maddie from DePere, follow-up question along those lines, wants to know if University of Wisconsin-Madison or University of Minnesota had anything to do with the development of Roundup. Maddie asks, what universities were involved?
That's a good question, you know, and I think one of the things that I would encourage listeners to do is to speak up in the same way that I did. File FOIAs, these Freedom of Information Act requests with your public institutions to tease out some of those relationships. I'll say that my understanding of the history of Roundup's creation is actually pretty interesting. The company was producing all detergent, which was mentioned earlier, ALL. You might see it at the grocery store. All detergent was a Monsanto creation, but it had phosphate-based builders in it. And at that time in the 60s, phosphate-based detergents were coming under fire because they were producing eutrophication in waterways. And so there was a move to ban phosphate-based detergents. Monsanto internally was trying to figure out what to do with all this phosphate that they had that was going into the detergent business. And so they took that phosphate and started playing with it and discovered that, you know what? Wow, glyphosate, this thing is a really effective herbicide. And so you could argue that it was really an internal fix that was so key for them. They needed to figure out how to pivot out of this phosphate-based detergent business. And a lot of that material that went into all ended up being moved into Roundup. So in the book, I call it a strategic exit. That was the term they used inside the company. So there was a kind of internal pursuit of this, a product in part because of the pressures they were facing to get rid of this supply of phosphate material that they had.
Environmental historian Bart Elmore writes, in Seed Money, Monsanto could never fully break free of the chemical economy it helped create. When you think of Monsanto, what comes to mind? What is the story of Monsanto's blockbuster chemical Roundup to you? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Bart Elmore here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the chemical giant Monsanto, founded in St. Louis, how it shaped a global food system over the generations. And about a dozen years ago, I was visiting in-laws in suburban St. Louis. We checked out the Arch, of course, the zoo, Blueberry Hill. And I got a bee in my bonnet, wanted to do a drive-by of Monsanto's mothership headquarters. All I recall is this perfectly manicured, lush green, rolling hill, expansive campus with these very, very large guard gates leading up to a giant building. So check that off the list. What is your Monsanto story? 800-642-1234. Bart Elmore wrote the book Seed Money. He's with us for about 7 more minutes. So, Bart, I was nodding my head, yes, yes, when you described their suburban headquarters, but I didn't understand why they moved their headquarters out of St. Louis proper, and that had to do with white middle-class workers.
Yeah, I think this is a story in part of the confluence of what's going on in terms of civil rights and white flight in some ways at that time, this massive migration out of the city of largely white middle-class folks into the suburbs as a result of changing dynamics in the city. And I wanted to kind of point that out, that we're seeing this simultaneous kind of segregation of society along racial lines, which, you know, had the roots of this are deep in St. Louis. But at the same time that I could also see this kind of segregation of Monsanto's more dirty plants, which are still located in many ways kind of in the East St. Louis area and down towards the riverfront. And maybe this kind of more clean looking biotech life sciences company that you see when you come out to their headquarters out in the suburbs. And I actually did that when I went. I just did a day where I went to both locations. I went to kind of the chemical plants that are manufacturing some of these compounds, even today, at these big plants down at the riverfront, and then kind of went out to the suburbs. And it was really a stark moment where I kind of saw that very clearly, that segregation, again, that is also reflected in the racial segregation of the city, but also in terms of that kind of separation of the pollution past from the shiny future. And I think it's one of the ways that I think it got companies like Bayer to buy them, you know, this German chemical company in 2018 to say, look at how nice this is. We're a life sciences firm. And that stuff of the past is the past. What we see in the book is that stuff is not past. As our callers have mentioned, you know, this still affects people's lives even today. And the real question is what the future of a company like Bayer, which acquired Monsanto, is going to be, given this history that they've acquired as well.
Let's bring in Carrie in Eau Claire. Carrie, hi, what's your story?
Hi, good morning. I used to work at a home for the developmentally disabled. It was a state-run place in Chippewa Falls, and there was, you know, thousands of clients there. And the talk was always that the parents were exposed to Agent Orange. Either they were farmers or Mom used to walk up and down the road when she was pregnant. And so the developmental disabilities were incredible. And I find that to be really feasible, knowing what it's done to our soldiers in Vietnam and Also, I just wanted to point out that, as maybe you've already discussed, that there are many, many farmers that got in trouble with Monsanto because Monsanto's seeds flew into their crops and cross-pollinated, and they got sued by Monsanto for that. So anyway, Monsanto has deep pockets and lots of friends in the Senate and the House. So that's it. Thank you.
Carrie, thank you for those thoughts, Bart.
Yeah, thanks for the call. You know, one of the things that was so, moving when I was writing this story was traveling to Vietnam and spending time with U.S. veterans who had moved back to Vietnam, who lived in Hanoi or lived in formerly Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City in the south, and who had come back to help be a part of the solution, you know, to spend time, for example, with kids that are in these organizations that are trying to deal with Agent Orange and its effects, and to just be a part of trying to rewrite history for the better. And it was a really a moving time to spending listening to them. And you know, understand these are folks who have kind of truly moved entirely their lives and transitioned to living in Vietnam and I felt that story was so poignant, especially given the silence that we've heard from the corporations that produce the products. And you talk about deep pockets and things like that. I mean, I think that's what's so startling, is that there's a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of folks that are trying to do the right thing here. And yet the question is, given this history, where are the firms, you know, and is there a role for a company like Bayer to play? It's, you know, a company like Bayer right now is facing so much pressure as a result of Roundup, because of all the litigation that has emerged. There's been three major cases that came out in California against the firm. There were thousands and thousands of cases in the wings with people claiming that, you know, their exposure to Roundup was linked to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This was all linked to a 2015 IARC, International Agency for Research on Cancer, study that came out with the World Health Organization that found that looking at a meta-analysis of all the data, that IARC found that there was that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen. Mm. Now, this is, of course, hotly debated today. The EPA has suggested that their studies show differently. Of course, there's still the question of what studies are they looking at? Is, you know, that firewall we were talking about earlier, to what degree were those decisions influenced by this? But I think it's one of these questions of, what is Bayer going to do? It's facing all this onslaught with all this. And I have a real, you know, I'm wondering internally, is something going to pivot? Is something going to change? You got to understand, this is a company that was worth about twice as much as it's worth now after it bought Monsanto. It faced a massive backlash. Investors even filed suit against the company.
And Bart, we are out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Bart Elmore, Associate Professor of Environmental History at The Ohio State University, new book called Seed Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.